This is a continuation of the oral history interview of Shirley Bridge. Today's date is August the 8th, 2001, and this is mini disc tape number 3. Can you finish that sentence?
Yes, I think that this particular group I'm talking about, I believe, doesn't have any Jewish members in it at all. And it may be because socially they were not there at the time the club was formed, or socially they don't associate with those people. And then again, it could be because these people were voted out. There is a club called the Men's University Club that is like that. And they always brag they have one Jewish member, Dr. Doctor, but Dr. Doctor was the son of a friend of my father's, and he married a very well-to-do woman outside of the community. But Herb would not allow them to go into, when he was on the board of Washington Mutual, would not allow them to use Washington Mutual for the Men's University Club, you know, as a club headquarters because of that.
I'd like to understand the larger picture of how power and clout and money factor into
anti-Semitism.
Well, first I'd say how it's established in the Seattle circuits, mm-hmm. and then seems to be parallels within the Jewish community that. And because you yourself have, I think, maybe risen financially in your life, you've witnessed a lot of that. Mm. And I'm wondering.
Well, I always had non-Jewish friends. That was a thing. It's hard for me to say, but I think most of it was, it's a society group, like Broadmoor. That was also a covenant at one time. It isn't anymore. And these are people who had the money to get where they wanted, and they thought they were exclusive, and they didn't want to mingle with the lesser people. And Jews and blacks and Asians were the lesser people. When I first joined the Women's University Club in 63, the Schwabacher woman, she was very well known in town, and she was traveling in Europe, and she spoke French. She was a member, and the Lindenbergers, who were a banking family. But I had a heck of a time getting in, and I didn't even realize it. And since then, they've let people of color in. The woman next door is a woman of color, and she is in. And the Asian women, I just signed for one of my friends. But a lot of it is money. An awful lot of it is perception. And the city has always had a large Scandinavian population, and they're very fair. They maybe have their prejudices, but they vote fairly. And I think that voting makes a lot of difference in some of the laws that have been passed.
As a Scandinavian city, or blonde city,
mm-hmm.
how has that made being different more obvious, or?
No, not really, because there's a large Italian population here too, and a fairly large Greek population. And when I was growing up, my grandfather had homes on First Hill. That was a Japanese community. And I think I told you that they went to Japanese school after school, and some Jews went to Hebrew school after school. But I think it's sort of a nationwide type of thing, where people are now beginning to understand that different people are okay. This has always been a very heavily Asian city, too. And I must say, the Scandinavians may not like Jews, and may think a little bit anti-Semitically, but they're innately fair. They came from a politically active group of people who were kind of put upon too, and who didn't have much money.
Have you experienced the anti-Semitism that you're talking about, either by an obvious comment or by unconscious
sure.
actions?
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what you mean?
Well, I was on a bus one day, and some black people were saying some derogatory remarks about Jews, and I interrupted, and I said, "They're the best friends you've ever had," and that was all. So I think that kept them quiet. That's just an example.
How about the Scandinavians in particular?
Well, two of my best friends are Norwegians. And the thing is that they know I'm Jewish, and we love each other, but I also know that if push came to shove, I could depend on one, but I couldn't depend on the other.
So you were just saying, if I can repeat what you last said, that anti-Semitism is alive and well in Seattle. So you're saying, though, that it's not really an obvious anti-Semitism.
No.
It's a quiet anti-Semitism.
That's right.
Was it always that way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're very subtle in Seattle. And I think most people don't even consider that they have any anti-Semitic feelings at all.
I'm curious about how it, moving to the Jewish community,
mm-hmm.
how is it that the Jewish community here has dealt with anti-Semitism? Maybe specifically within Temple or discussed it? Have there been particular events or historically that have caused those discussions?
Well, I haven't had any with the organized groups, but we do discuss it, of course, in the American Jewish community. And we discuss the what might happen afterwards, you know, not just the reaction to it, not just anti-Semitism, but there's always been. The Washington Athletic Club is a great example of anti-Semitism. During the Depression, they took Jews in because they needed the money. After the Depression, they didn't, and Herb had a hard time getting in, even though some of his best Jewish friends were taken in during the Depression. So it's, and that hasn't been so many years ago.
What are the benefits to a Jew to belong to a club like the Washington Athletic Club?
And they get to know Jews. And the thing is, Herb, you know, has really done very well. He's gotten to be the first citizen, and he's gotten to be head of the club. And he's also been King Neptune. You know, these are the kind
What's
of...
What's King Neptune?
King Neptune, oh, this is seafarer. And they are supposed to be... He's Lord of the Seas. You know who Neptune was his trident. But what it is it's very interesting. He was the king, and the woman who is head of, Phyllis Campbell, who is head of U.S. Bank, is an Asian American who was queen. But
what are their responsibilities? Do they parade during the seafair parade?
Yes, and you ride in a little corvette, and you get to go to the pits, and you get to have police escort that our grandchildren loved it. Uh-huh. And you get to see the Blue Angels over.
The phenomenon of seafair fascinates me.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps just for the record, for someone listening to this, to understand the context, could you describe what exactly seafair it is? When did it begin?
Well, it probably began with the old potlatch, the old Indian, parades. And, gosh, I can't remember how many years this is.
Do you remember the potlatch parades?
No, I don't remember. I just remember hearing about it. And if you go over to some of the Indian, rites where you hear about it. But what it is it celebrates a certain time of year, and it celebrates the opening of boating season and all that type of stuff. And I can't tell you exactly what happened. You have to ask Herb about that, because I'm not sure he knows either.
So as his wife, have you participated in any way?
No, just watching. It's not my thing. But he supports me in what I do, and I support him in what he does sometimes. And we've been honored together in supporting each other in certain things.
Before we start talking about some of your community activism, I wanted to ask you a little bit about issues around money.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just talk a little bit or describe your relationship with money and class? And I mean, you went to Temple, and
mm-hmm.
that has its own kind of, it's known in the community as many, many wealthier people in the community.
Yeah, they
have gone
used
there.
To. It's not true anymore, but no, because first of all, I went to Sunday school, and people were nice to me. Secondly, I think that times have changed, and I used to be a good student. I got into the University of Washington sorority, Alpha Epsilon Phi, I'm sure only on my grades.
You also had a scholarship as well.
Yeah, but that was from pharmacy. This was just, I only stayed in the house 1 year. My aunt paid for it. It interfered with my lab, so I couldn't come out. And the boys never joined any fraternity. So,
I guess I'm asking about how it is that you grew up fairly poor, and how it is that in your lifetime you have seen gains in status.
Well, I must say this, that we all grew up the same during the Depression. And people with money didn't have money then. They had prestige, and that kind of went to their head sometime. But I think because after the Depression, everybody, and after World War II, people were given the opportunity to do something that would bring them better education and where they could do more for themselves in the way of money. But money was never a worry with me anyway. My mother made do with what she had, and father did too. And his father, they lived much better than we did during the Depression. But I think sometimes you stretch the envelope a little bit. I think it was just a matter of what's happened to everybody, you know, like the dot-com companies. These are young people, or people who have intelligence, who knew how to develop businesses and knew how to develop themselves and promote themselves. Herb and I don't go out with any special social group. I go out with a great many women of all classes. Now my friends who are the nurses and pharmacists don't have any money, but we've been together for 40 years and taken vacations. I enjoy their company. I'm comfortable with them. And then I have some younger friends, some of whom have money and some don't. As you get older, you find it's a matter of interests. I don't play cards. I never have. I don't play bridge or mahjong or even any games. I like to join organizations that do something for other people, and I think that makes a difference. But
at what point would you say that you felt more comfortable financially, whether it was because you were a dual income or the jewelry business was becoming very successful? What point would you say you bumped up in class and in your ability to give money to causes and things of that nature?
Well, we always gave money to causes. When my mother had no money, she'd give money. But I think you learn that at in your family. They were very charitable with what little they had. Bumping up is a matter of getting an education and associating with people who have like educations. But it wasn't always money. It was just a matter of working with the people who had the same ideas you did. And that was the way I always felt. Money doesn't mean that much to me anyway. I don't have a great many wants. And I'm just happy with what I have. I wouldn't want to be poor again. That wasn't fun either. But actually, I can get along on a little or a lot.
How would you describe power and clout in the Jewish community? How is it established? There is certainly a group of people that serve on boards, and then there are people that are, workaday. I mean, there's a whole vast different type.
Well, they're just like the rest of the population right now in Seattle. But if you're talking about the Jewish Federation, it's a patriarchal society, and we are working with a group of women. I started an endowment foundation, and we're going to have to get somebody to get us some clout there.
I'd like to hear about the establishment of the Women's Endowment at the Federation.
Foundation, Janet Gray and I started it, and we are now meeting with other people, the young people who are taking over, and I think they'll be doing a good job. I can't really tell you much more because we're going to meet tonight again and talk about it.
Well, I want to just understand what it is and why it was necessary.
Well, first of all, it was the foundation. There were a lot of women in the community who were not affiliated with Federation, and they wanted to do something, and we wanted to do something for the women in the Jewish community, especially along the lines of domestic violence and so forth. And so we decided to form a little group, and we would have women to breakfast, and we would ask them for donations, and we decided that we would ask them for $1,000 a year if they could give it, and more. But the problem is that Federation was not very cognizant of what we were doing or didn't approve, maybe thinking it would take away from something else. So what we did was decide that we were going to get ourselves a little more well-known and see if we could get a little bit more money from the women in the community who don't realize they have the means to give. But women are, and that isn't only the Jewish community. I belong to the Washington Women's Fund, and they too don't understand that they have a lot to give. I've often talked to some people in that community, and they say the same thing is true. You have to get women to understand that the money they have is theirs and they can use it as they wish.
What need will you be satisfying with the fundraising?
With the fundraising, we'll be able to give more money to women with who have been abused, women with children, women who are divorced. You know, like the Jewish Family Service is very good on the bottom level of that, but they need money from us to help with their programs. And we don't only give to the Jewish community, we give to the non-Jewish community too.
You've been called many nice things. I was going to say many things, but that
many
would be
things.
Inappropriate.
That's true. I have been called many things, believe me.
Uh-huh. You've been called a passionate community activist. You've been called a pioneer in the women's community. And I'm going to ask you to roster your many activities in women's causes. What are they?
Well, do you want me to look at the...
Here's your CV, but you can...
Oh, may I get my glasses?
Sure.
Well, let me see.
Especially well, ones that you'd like to talk about.
Well, of course, I'm very involved in AIDS Housing of Washington. And since we started that with a board of people who were about 13 years ago who had no money and really didn't know that much about AIDS and what was necessary till we started looking around and seeing people were dying, we started Bailey Boucher House. Now, the young woman who is head of it now, Betsy Lieberman, was there, and we needed a fundraiser, so what we did was get Michelle Hassan. Do you know Michelle? Well, Michelle, at that time, hadn't been a fundraiser for anything. She just fundraised out of the goodness of her heart for a federation or for our Jewish Family Service. And I said, that woman is able to do a good job. And we hired her, and that was her first job. And we raised a good deal of money. We raised about $8 million.
What motivated you to get involved with AIDS Housing?
Well, I was on the board of Harborview, and we saw an awful lot of patients who were AIDS infected. So what we did was we got some of the doctors to get together and give some money to a clinic. And then I thought, there was a woman who was a Presbyterian minister, and she said, oh, come on, we're going to start this group because outside of the hospital it will be helpful. And so Gwen Begley got me involved.
Can you spell her last name?
Begley.
Thank you. Uh-huh. And how has that work been fulfilling to you? I understand that they are about to dedicate cottages in your name.
Yes, well, you live long enough and you get something in your name. Yes, it's been very rewarding. My big problem with AIDS Housing in the beginning was that they had a place for single people with AIDS, mostly men. But, you know, there are a lot of families with AIDS and a lot of single mothers with AIDS and whose children, some of whom have AIDS. And I thought it was about time we had something for families for AIDS. And it's not just the cottages. We're building other units out in Rainier Valley, and there are condos we have. But it's a necessity.
Where will the Shirley Bridge, is it cottages, where will they be built?
They'll be built down on near Beach Drive in West Seattle.
How, being involved with this organization, what did you witness the city's interaction around galvanizing or avoiding the issue of AIDS? Because we're talking 1987, when people were really just cluing
in. In Mount Madison Park, we had a meet with people all the time, and even the builders and the construction people were against it. And it took a lot of work. It took a lot of talking, and it took a lot of... Well, first of all, we told them that it would be an addition to the area, and it was, because it brought other businesses in. And then we also told them that it was a necessity. You can't overlook it, you know. And some of the doctors came and talked, too. And then we got a group together to raise money. Paul Schell and a few of others.
Was he mayor at the time?
No. No, that's another story. But he finally gave me some money. And he and another fellow and I were co-chairs. And it was a necessity, and it's proven to be so. Now we're going nationwide.
What's that other story, Shirley? Okay, don't want to tell that story. What about resistance? And, you know, this is also the time ACT UP. There were other organizations.
Yeah, Well, they understood. I had friends I used to be with and hold till they died. It's sometimes too painful to even talk about, but here these people. ACT UP is some, you know, it brings attention, but the wrong kind of attention sometimes. But attention is attention. There's a Privacy Foundation as well as AIDS Housing and a lot of organizations now that are cooperating. And there's, you know, Marilee Leitner. She is one of our famous fundraisers, and she was a fundraiser for the zoo, too. She's a Jewish woman whose husband's a rabbi who is head of MAPS, the Multifaith AIDS Project, and so it's spreading.
But you've been active not only in this, you were also active at the same time with other organizations.
Oh, yes. Let me see. Well, I think they, in 87, I can't remember what I was doing in 87. Oh, yeah, I guess I was on the Judicial Review Committee and...
What was the Judicial Review Committee?
Oh, that's... Well, first of all, I was on the Judicial Screening Committee that screened judges for Superior Court and Municipal Court.
Was that a volunteer or an appointed position?
I was asked by the League of Women Voters to be on that. And I was a non-lawyer member, and I was on that for a couple of years. I only excused myself because when my daughter-in-law came in for an interview for a Superior Court judge at that time, I...
But your activities with the League of Women Voters, what has the League of Women Voters done in this area? Have you been active with them, or was it...
I'm fairly active. Just, really, I'm not this, the information desk. I've never been a president or vice president or an officer there. But I've made a lot of friends, and we think that we are able to influence people because we go out and we talk and we listen, and we study and study and study. I think sometimes we study too much, and I think we do influence voting in a way. It's an organization that's respected very much. I can't say more because I am more proactive.
So you're talking about the fact that the League of Women Voters tends to study things as opposed to going out and on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some examples of the times when you have gone out on the streets, when you've been proactive?
Well, for Daryl and for abortion and for, let's see, what else? For women's rights, yeah.
When did you feel the call? When did you feel the need to get out into the street?
I was in pharmacy for so many years, and, you know, it gets to you finally when you hear somebody come in and say, I want to see the pharmacist, and you say, you're the pharmacist, and they say, I want to talk to the man. I told one guy, well, you don't want to talk to me, just turn around and go out. You know, you have to be tough. I think that kind of starts things going. Let's see, what else did I...
I think I'm just looking at an article that was written about some of your many works here, and one of them was with Voice for Choice. Was that a short stint, or was that...
Yeah, just a short stint, Voice for Choice.
You served as well on the Seattle Women's Commission.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was the Seattle Women's Commission? When was that, and how did you get involved?
That was the one I told you about, wasn't it? And the Seattle Women's Commission was started by Mayor Ullman. And it was about 20 years ago, little bit more than that. I run out of time, more like 30 now. And it was started because we thought we needed a voice in the community. Women needed a voice. And so we went, the mayor said, okay, and we were appointed. And then we decided that we would have an office. And that was when we had a lot of trouble. Women are from all groups, from radical women on to Republican women, got together. And we would meet maybe once a week. And finally we decided, well, unless we get an office, we won't have credibility. So we went down to the city council, and then they pushed me there. And so I had to speak. And we asked for an office of women's rights, and we interrupted the council until we got it. And finally, they said yes, and we started the office, and there was a former state representative who became our exec. And it worked out well because it served a purpose. It was a group of women who got together outside of politics, actually, but we were very political because we went to Olympia and we talked to the people there, and we, in fact, before we even talked to them, we said we will go into a bank and try to get some money without having to use our husbands' or fathers' names. So I went into a bank and I asked for a loan of $5,000. Of course, I had a lot more money than that because I was working, so I just turned around the corner, came back, and he was on the phone. I said, who are you calling? Well, I'm just calling your husband. I said, oh, no, you're not. I said, you know, I'm not taking the loan, but next year this time, you're not going to be able to do that. So we got the bill passed.
The bill?
It was a bill to make co-management of community property equal. There were always co-management of community, and it was always community property, but the manager was always the man. And so we made either, and now we're both managers. And that worked out very well. And then also the Fair Employment Practices Ordinance in the city, where there was not to be any discrimination because of sex, sexual orientation, color, or religion.
What year was that it passed?
Around 1970.
Around the same time as the other bill?
Yeah.
Who were the other women that served on this commission?
Well, it was Kathleen O'Connor, and I'm trying to remember whether Helen Summers served on it. It's pretty hard when you're on so many things that you forget who's on what.
Well, I'm curious about then the coalescence of these players,
mm-hmm.
because it takes a lot. I mean, you're so humble that you said it as if you just walked into the mayor's office and got yourself, you know, appointed. But really, it takes a lot to go from being a community activist to getting legislature passed.
Yes. Well, we all worked together on it. But, I can't tell you any more than that. I don't think we did anything wonderful. But
Where did connections have to do with it?
Well, I was a treasurer of the 43rd District Democratic Club. And it was sort of a democratic regime, and we just went in there and we asked them. In fact, we insisted, you don't ask, and we got it passed. We also got a very mild bill for abortion passed in the 70s also.
Can you describe what that bill was?
Well, it made abortions legal in Seattle. I don't know about the state, I've forgotten about that, but people used to have to go into back alleys, or there were one or two abortionists, which pharmacists always knew. Some were good, some were not, and then, of course, there were a lot of people who killed themselves. And then a lot went to Japan or out of the country.
As a pharmacist, did you have contact with women or on the sly try to steer women in the right direction?
Well, there were two doctors in town who didn't do it legally, but they delivered children and so forth, and they would give pills to the women, and if that didn't work, they would do an abortion, but that wasn't legal.
Do you know what the pills were at that time?
Sure.
What were they?
They were ergoapiol and quinine. I think they're still used. I don't know. The morning after pill is a little different. But if you saw as many desperate or sick women or or women who harm themselves, you would certainly be in favor of abortion.
You've also been very active in other women's health issues and on other organizations and boards. What are some of those women's organizations?
Well, they weren't all women's organizations. We did have a women's health organization, but that kind of fizzled out.
Is that the Women for Healthcare Equity Through Reform and Education?
Yeah, uh-huh. That is now being taken over by a national company. And then we also, let's see, what else did I have here?
Why did that fizzle out? I'm just curious.
Well, we couldn't raise enough money from the government to keep it going. You really need government funds to keep something going, and that's what this new one will be doing. Mm-hmm. Let's see, I was on the Diabetes Research Council. We started, it's been a long time ago, a few of us started a group called the Diabetes Research Council, and we started the Williams Chair in Diabetes. Now, Dr. Williams was a well-known diabetes doctor. His problem was that he died too soon, but we still kept the chair, and we raised millions of dollars for the chair.
Is that at UW?
At the UW. And there was one family in town whose son was a diabetic, and I got him involved, and so it was, it grew and grew, and now we have the Diabetes Research Council, which does research on diabetes. I'm off of the board, but there are people who are still on it that I know.
Was there a personal contact that you had with someone with diabetes that impelled you to be involved with this particular organization?
Well, my aunt had diabetes, but no, that wasn't true. I met somebody called Dick, well, two, called Dick and Julia Maccabee, who had lost the child to diabetes, and he was a diabetic. It's interesting, the son who had diabetes had children who had no diabetes, and he died. And the son who didn't have diabetes had two grandchildren, who children of this Maccabee's son who had diabetes. So diabetes is all over the place, and you just don't know who's going to get it. So that's what we do. We did fundraising for that.
Were there any other women's health organizations? Because as a cancer survivor, did you get involved with cancer organizations?
No. If people call me up individually, or if some of the doctors tell me they need somebody to give them the patient a little bit of a lift, I will call. I think it's a little maudlin to get together and tell your problems.
So when you call, what are they asking you to do?
Well, you just kind of cheer them up and tell them it's been a long time since you've been alive, and that this is a new form of medication, new form of chemo, and just give them a little pat on the head. I think that's about what they do in those groups, except they go over their problems, and I don't think that's healthy. You know, what I don't know, I've always had the ability to live each day and not look forward or backward, you know, and you have to do that, otherwise you don't survive, because my first bout was when John was 4 years old and Dan was a few months old, and they told me I had a 25% chance of survival, so what you do is you keep going.
What was your first cancer?
Of the rectum. I've had a colostomy for 45 years.
What then was the procedure for a colostomy?
The same as it is now. They remove all of your sigmoid colon and they put an opening on your stomach.
So how is a young woman, I mean, that's very unusual, is it not, for a young woman to have gotten a colostomy?
I don't know. It's happening more and more. Yeah, I suppose so. But, you know, you do the best you can. It takes a while to get it regulated.
Mm-hmm. So when was your second episode of cancer?
Oh, I had cancer of the uterus 3 years after that. And then breast. And then bladder. And then the cecum, which is the lower end of the colon. That one spread.
When you had cancer of the uterus, how old were you?
Let me see.
You had already had your three children?
Two children. Yeah, that's all. Yeah, well, let me think now.
Oh, sorry.
I can't remember. You know, I'm not very good. I don't dwell on these things, so I...
Yes.
So it was about gotten, well, about 40 years ago.
Did they advise you to get a hysterectomy, to do chemo? What were
there was no chemo. They used to sew radium pellets into your uterus, and then you have to sit there for 4 days and not raise your head because you would radiate the room, and they stuck you someplace up in the hospital, and then they would take the uterus and ovaries and everything out, which is what I told them to do. You know, I wouldn't have wanted to keep anything. You want to survive or you don't, you know.
What is it that in you that made you a strong survivor? What is it that you could put your finger on, your talent for survival?
Well, I had two kids, and I thought it was necessary to raise them, or help to raise them, and then also I enjoyed my work. I enjoyed what I did.
Well, all this time, you're very active, obviously, in the community as well. How did you juggle it all?
Well, every other night or every third night, you have to be home. But, you know, you still can go out and do things.
What are some of the... Were there other organizations or community service that you wanted to highlight?
Well,
I know you're the recipient of a number of awards that you're very proud of.
Well, it's nice to have my... I haven't done anything the other women haven't done before me.
For example, well, maybe I want to ask if you could describe a little bit how it is that you, it's very unique. It takes a lot of effort, a lot of guts to get out there and do what you have done. And I'm wondering whether these opportunities were also for personal growth of any kind, or was it mostly, you know, your volunteerism was outwardly motivated?
Well, I think that everything in pharmacy was for personal growth, you know, because I enjoyed what I did. And personal growth is important, but I would say it's a combination, you know, I can't just pinpoint it. There were certain things I did a long time ago, like the Seattle Opportunities Industrial Center, which was an organization founded by black people for work in the central area. That's since gone off, by the way, of other groups. But, and then there was a school for the Northwest School for the Hearing Impaired Children that I was on the board of, and I still support that monetarily. It's a school that got children into the mainstream of high school and grade school, because most of these kids were profoundly deaf. I've always been interested in the medical end of things, you know. And let's see.
What are some of the greatest satisfactions and rewards that you've gotten from your community service?
Well, I've met a lot of good people who have like ideas, and it's given me an opportunity to get out into the community and raise money, because I've met a lot of people. And I think that's very important. Networking is where it's at, you know, especially for women.
Can you say something more about that?
Well, all I know is that if you don't get out there and get to know people, and, you know, it's men as well as women, you need to have somebody who is going to be your mentor. And I have a lot of mentors around, because I believe that what you, when you get into something, you have to get into it a little more deeply than just on the surface. And so I do that. I haven't given any speeches for a long time, but I have been active.
Who are your mentors, Shirley?
Well, first of all, this woman who started the Women's Endowment Foundation, that was Janet Gray and Marilee Leitner. These are young women who really have been mentors. You know, it's hard to believe. And then some of the women out at the School of Pharmacy, Joy Pline, and a young woman, Karen Dawson, who does some of the continuing education out there. And, excuse me, and some of the women over at the League of Women Voters, too. Betty Sullivan, and another one, Phyllis Bagley. So,
what do they teach you?
Well, one of them taught me how to read political activities, you know. Politics is tough. And they did teach me something that I really am not very good at, the patience in reading and digesting and doing some research on things. I have a tendency to shoot from the hip, you know. I know as much as I want to know, and then I just like to have an activity. But the League of Women Voters has always been known for being very, very proper in the way it looks at everything. And, you know, because of that, people respect the League. But I think if we were... I enjoyed being on the Judicial Screening Committee, and that was the League of Women Voters who put me on that. And then I was appointed by Senator Murray to the U.S. District Court Screening Committee in 97, and I enjoyed that too.
Were you the only layperson without a JD that was on these screening committees?
On the first one, yeah. And the other, no. There were others too.
What were your roles and responsibilities?
Well, you had to interview people for federal courts, and that's what we did. And we voted, and I didn't always agree with them, but,
Did this stem from your activities with the 43rd Democratic?
No, I think not. I knew her before, but I think it was because I was on the Judicial Screening Committee before.
What has it meant to be part of the Democratic Party? Have you been a delegate? Have you...
No, I've never been a delegate, only to the county convention. I like to support individual candidates because I think they need it more than anyone else. And I also like to support the county, not the National Democratic Party as much, because I think the county is really thinks the way I do, and I enjoy them.
So over the years, who are some candidates that you stood behind and were either excited by your successes or their successes, or disappointed?
Well, Pat Thibodeau, who is a senator in the 43rd District, she's excellent. And then Helen Summers, who is a representative in, I think it's the 37th District, or 36th District. She is a wonderful addition to the legislature. She is an expert on finance. And let's see, was there anybody else? No, I wish I could say something about... Well, I do support representatives out of the state. I support Barbara Boxer and Feinstein because they're liberal and they are working hard for women's rights. And I always gave to Hillary Clinton, too. But I didn't know her personally, although she came here. And let's see, was there anybody else? You know, and Paige Miller and the people on the port, we know each other. And I think it's very important here. And there are a couple of Jewish representatives that I know, too.
Such as?
Well, I can get the names for you if you want to turn that off a minute.
We can fill them in later.
Yeah, and there are two, Rudner, and then there's another one who is a physician also and is a representative.
How active have you been in their campaigns? Is it through financial support?
Yeah, mostly financial support.
What kind of contributions does one make to these campaigns?
Well, you make the limit. I was active in Sidran's campaign, too. I gave the limit on that. I don't know whether it'll help or not. I hope so.
What is the limit, $1,000?
No, I think it's $600 for this. And then there, Ron Sims, too. I've always been active in the county council campaigns, too. But mostly, he's a good county exec. And I haven't been too active in the mayor's campaigns or the city council campaigns lately.
How about the governor's?
Yes.
Were you supportive of Governor Locke?
Oh, yeah. He was a good friend. I supported him when he was a county exec. I ran one of his campaigns.
You did?
Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Well, what we did was, he is a lot different than he was then. He was shy then. So we got him out among people, and I got a building, a room in a building from Martin Seelig, and some parking from Joe Diamond, and we had a headquarters. And he was quite good after he got in.
What kind of, was this a paid position? Or was this a volunteer position?
Volunteer.
Yes, go ahead.
I haven't been paid for anything except being on the board of certain organizations.
Well, I'm just curious to understand how it is that one generically gets chosen to be on boards. What does it take to be on a board?
Well, first of all, on the big boards, it's all taken over by people who have been very active in banking and business, and mostly men. But with others, you're appointed by some of the county council people. And that's the way it goes. And then also you can be appointed by people in the group, you know, like senior services, they ask you to come in. Like Jewish Family Service, they ask you to come in.
What's the culture of some of these boards, either generically or vis-a-vis men and women?
Well, most of the boards, that's the thing about Seattle, there are an awful lot of women in politics and a lot of women in judgeships. And so there are a lot of women on volunteer boards, but not a lot on business boards where you get paid a lot of money. I think there's only one woman on the board of Washington Mutual, and there are a lot of very qualified women. Although there is a women's group, and I haven't been to them lately, but that is trying to get women interested in investments and in banking again. But that isn't really my field. I'm not too good at it.
You also served as director on the board of Benbridge Jewelers. What is that responsibility entailed, and how many stores are there now, and how many states?
About 65.
And when you became director, when was that?
Oh, gosh, in the very beginning. We only had a few stores. But I didn't ever take an active interest in our business. The board just made decisions for the stores, and we all voted on it. But we pretty much let those who are managing do most of the thinking for their stores. We and John and Ed are the co-presidents, you know, of this. Well, one is vice president of the store, and they run it pretty much. You know, they don't ask my opinion anymore because we were bought out by Warren Buffett. He doesn't ask my opinion at all.
When did Warren Buffett purchase?
Just this last year.
But for how many years was Herb involved with Benbridge Jewelers?
Well, all of his life, I guess, since he was 18.
And what was your involvement in relationship to the store, or even in terms of the name recognition, which it's on the corner of a very prominent
Fourth
and Pike in Seattle? The name Bridge is a well-known name in Seattle.
Yeah, it is. I think that opened some doors for you, although it didn't for me in medicine. They didn't know from Adam. But it has for Herb. It's opened a lot of doors, and it's nice to be known. All I do now is if people ask me to come in, and I will, and if they ask me to intercede for their buying, I will do that. But that's about all.
I imagine, in a sense, though, being the wife of a man who owns such a prominent jewelry store, that a lot of women would want to showcase, be a walking advertisement.
Uh-huh.
How have you felt around images of women and jewelry and your role in, I mean, you're a fairly simple, tailored
mm-hmm.
woman?
Yes.
Yeah. So I was asking how it was that you related to the jewelry business yourself as a woman who, many women love jewelry.
Well, you know, jewelry is nice, and anytime people ask me to intercede in their behalf or come down to the store and help them out, I will do so. You know, people, what I'm happy about is women aren't waiting for men to get jewelry anymore. You go in and they'll choose something and they'll pay for it themselves, and that makes it kind of nice because that shows they're in control. I have been on a lot of boards and commissions where people don't have much in the way of means, and I think it's an insult to people to overdo, because and as a lot of people feel that they like to see these things, but they don't like to see them on you. I would not feel good about it. I'm sensitive to that. So otherwise, but I don't sell and never did in the store, not since my mother-in-law heard me say something about, oh, this is just as good, and it was gold plate, it wasn't gold. That was the end of my selling career.
So. As you watch the store expand, what is it about the jewelry business that has happened in the last 50 years?
Well, the stores have grown in the mall department, and we are on, we have our webpage too. I don't know whether I would want to buy medicine or jewelry over the web. I think that it may be good for some people, but I like to see, and I like things explained to me. You know, I'd like to look under the microscope myself. But I think probably the mall's developing, I think, and giving people more of an opportunity to go to different jewelry stores and compare.
It used to be, I understand here in Seattle, that there were a lot of jewelry stores.
There were, uh-huh. There were Friedlander's and Hardy's, and of course Benbridge, and let's see, what else? I'm trying to remember. But Hardy's and Friedlander's were very big. And they were big in China and silver, too. And we were kind of the small people on the block. But Hardy's and Friedlander's kind of just folded up. They were too elegant, you know. People wanted something less intimidating.
And what is it about the Benbridge jeweler that survived?
Well, first of all, we knew location, 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 and we knew where to go. I think I give credit to Herb and to Bob and to John and to Ed for that. They knew where to go, and they took advantage of new type of developments, which were the centers. And then also they, Bob and Herb and the boys too, were very cognizant of advertising. And you advertise over television when you have people who are able to sit down and look at it, but you have to know your location too, and the location of many, especially in California, when you're in a car, you advertise by the radio. So, you know, there's a lot to do. It's a big operation. I don't know how they even keep track of it. We like to keep our people, and we do promote from within.
So you said you were bought out by Warren Buffett mm-hmm. a year ago. As a director, were you involved with that decision?
Well, no, actually it was, a lot of us were not involved with it. I think it was mainly Ed and John, because they were the managers at that time. And they were looking to the next generation who were not interested, you know.
Why do you think that is? It's a family business that your father-in-law started,
yeah. Well, his father-in-law started it. He really did.
And your son went into the business, did he not?
Yeah, after he practiced law for a while.
So the next generation being who?
His son, and who was an attorney, and Becky. Becky, who is interested in blowing glass, and although she does work down there. And she's very good with display and making things with her hands. I don't really know exactly.
I want to shift gears a little bit.
Okay, go ahead.
I want to know a little bit about how you and your husband, together or separately, spend your leisure time.
Well, Herb likes the motorcycle, and I did for a while, but the last 2 years I haven't been able to, because once I jumped off the motorcycle and landed flat, and I don't want to do that again because I'm too old. We take vacations together. We take vacations separately. And
I'd like to hear a little bit more about the motorcycling.
Oh, well, I didn't take up motorcycling until I was 65, and then I said I was expendable, so I took it up, and for about 12 years I rode on the back. I'm not very mechanical, so I didn't have my own. and Herb just recently got a new motorcycle. We used to go on trips east of the mountains and, you know, down the coast. And it was fun. Well, when I was in better shape, but I'm almost 80, so it makes it tough.
Herb was part of this Hell's Rotarians.
Oh, yes, and he loves it. He just had a complete knee, and he still is motorcycling.
What is the motorcycle culture for folks over 65?
Well, but they feel like, I imagine it's for the same for everyone. They like the idea of the freedom of having the wind blowing in their hair or their scalp, and they like the idea of the open road. It's not even companionship, because we never used to have a lot of people we went with. It's dangerous to have a big group on the road. So it's just the idea of the freedom to get places and to not be encompassed in a car. I think it's kind of a kid thing, you know?
Did you have the little headset so you could communicate with each other?
Yeah, absolutely. But, and you know, you can get places faster and you don't have to worry about parking. But the thing is that it's kind of a, I think for the men, it's kind of a macho thing. I'm not sure. Although a lot of women are riding, too, their own bikes. If I were mechanical, I'd ride my own, but I'm not. I can't even do bicycling. I can't keep a bicycle straight. I have to have a tricycle. So,
do you have any other hobbies and special interests?
Hobbies, special interests. Well, I used to exercise. In my little rowing machine. Hobbies, I don't know. I don't write poetry, but I do have friends who, well, what I do is probably, my hobbies are probably going on vacations and just, and I don't have any real hobbies.
Where do you like to go on vacation?
Someplace where it's warm. I like to go to, San Francisco. I like to go to Hawaii, and this is the second cruise I've been on. I'll see how I like that.
Where was the first one that you took?
Oh, I went a far afield. That was the Western Mediterranean. I'm Western Caribbean, and this will be the Eastern Caribbean. And we'll probably boil in August.
You have also a home you mentioned in Whidbey Island.
Yes.
When did you purchase that?
When John got out of the service. He still owed about 6 years, you know. And he had gone to law school, and he was stationed up there. And Herb kind of conned me into it. He said, well, what if John's stationed up here? Luckily, he was stationed up there. He'd heard from me. And he kept the house all that time. And he was stationed up at Whidbey Island, up at the air station up there. And he enjoyed it. And he kept the house all going for us. And then they just built a house next door, and so we have our little compound up there. It's relaxing for Herb to go up there. He enjoys it. And I do too, in a way, but there's not that much to do. You know, he likes to get out and garden and lie in the sun, and I can't do those things. So what I usually do is just, I help him a little, and then I read.
What kind of reading do you take up?
Well, we have a lot of magazines.
Who do you subscribe to? What are some
the
magazines?
The New Yorker and the National Geographic and the New Republic. And then I have a lot of magazines from our professions. And so I have a lot of those. And I enjoy reading about those. I also like mysteries.
Any particular authors?
Oh, no, not particularly. I like I like the Kellerman family. I think they write okay. That's all right. But Neil Marsh is the one I like, and some of the older writers. Let's see, and what I'm going to be reading as soon as I can get it is the Graham book.
Catherine Graham's new memoir.
And what is it, personal memory or personal history? I can't remember. And that's the one I'm waiting for. You know, you have to back order that. I didn't realize.
Why is it important to you to read her book or her memoir?
Well, first of all, she's an interesting woman, and I'd like to know how much, you know, her father was Jewish. I'd like to know whether there was any Judaism in the family.
Why do you think that matters?
I'd like to know that some important people, Jewish women, are important. I wonder if anybody ever thought of interviewing her. Would have been nice. She still has some sisters, but I'm sure that they're not as interesting as she.
What about shopping? Do you, is that a leisure activity for you, like it is for many women, and Jewish women love the shopping?
I don't shop at all. I have a woman that, Toshi, who she has since had broken her hip, but she is at Nordstrom's. I hate to shop. I always have, because my father made all my clothes, so I didn't have to shop. So she picks something out, and if I like it, she'll bring it up here. She's very nice. If I like it, I keep it. If I don't, why, I may go down. But no, I don't. I hate to shop.
Because shopping is often a women-centered activity.
Herb likes to shop. I drive him nuts because I go through a store and don't see anything I want. Once in a while, we will buy some art, but not a lot. And I like to go to the museum, and I especially like the museum up at Volunteer Park, the Asian Museum. I grew up with that, you know, and I like that. But I don't have any strong collector's desires or anything like that. I do like some of the old books over here, and that's about it. I do read a lot.
Are there any restaurants or locations in Seattle other than the Asian Art Museum that you frequent that your friendships and networks enjoy?
We go out a lot. There are a lot of restaurants here. There's one down the street, an inexpensive one called Ohana, which is a combination of Hawaiian and Japanese food. And then there are a lot of expensive restaurants, you know, if you want to go to them. I just don't usually do that. But, I haven't. I like the fish restaurants. But what we usually do is I have some people come in and we talk. And some of my friends, we just go to Macrina's. You know, Pat Thibodeau, the senator, likes to go to Macrina's. And then some of the others just like to go up here to the Cherry Street Grill. And it seems to me it's kind of a fun place to meet people from the neighborhood.
I was going to say, you've moved to Belltown, or you've been in Belltown for a while.
A long time.
It's shifted a lot. What have you witnessed about the changes in Belltown? It's really where a lot of growth has happened.
Yeah, too much, I think. I think they're overextended. I found that it's the apartments are, this apartment is still full, but an awful lot are going to be empty, and they aren't even going to be. There are apartments that are rented and apartments that are condos. I think that they're going to have a lot of trouble renting them. For AIDS housing, we have to go up to Madison to get something that's cheap enough. But an awful lot of people are crying, especially those who are selling commercial properties. There's some in this building who are doing that. So I've noticed that it's over-urbanized now, too much. And I think Capitol Hill has stayed pretty much the same. I like it, especially on 14th and 15th. And of course, the park is wonderful.
Do you enjoy some of your leisure time with your grandchildren? How many grandchildren do you have?
Well, they're teenagers now. I don't see too much of them. They come over here when they want to swim or work out. And we do go on vacations together to Hawaii, Jan and Dan and the boys and her folks, and I, and Herb usually goes skiing then. Herb has his activities and I have mine. And
can you describe what those are?
Well, he likes to ski and he likes to motorcycle. And I used to motorcycle, I don't ski anymore. And then he'll go to Hawaii with me, part of that is business. And then I go up, we go up to Vancouver, Victoria, and I do that with the women, too. And we go to Nevada. We go to Las Vegas because we have stores there. We have a store in Las Vegas. Well, yeah, we've taken them to Las Vegas and to Reno. But now that they're grown, we go to Hawaii that way. My grandkids, when they were younger, they lived in, you know, California, and I used to go down there and babysit, but now that they live on Queen Anne, one is 15, one is 18, one is lives on Magnolia, 20, and she's going to school, and so is the 18-year-old, and the 31-year-old's in Boston, so I don't have too many to babysit. The 15-year-old comes over once in a while and stays overnight.
Well, we talked about your relationship to mothering, but I'm wondering if your relationship to grandmothering was different or similar?
A little bit different. Becky came over to me every day after school for about a year, and we did our math together and so forth. And that was interesting. And then Zach did too, I think, for a little while, but it was more tutoring than anything else. And then we'd go shopping. They liked to shop. And they would drag me around. And I would try to be pleasant, because that is a lot of walking around, because they look at everything. So, I have a good relationship with them. It isn't real, real close. They don't confide in me, except when they want to ask something. They don't even ask a medical deal anymore. Becky does, because their mother's a doctor. You know. So, but I don't have this clingy type of relationship that maybe some grandmothers have. And I don't call them every day. I call them when they're home alone, usually, to make sure they're okay. But they have their own lives to live, too.
Well, talking about Becky and your daughters-in-law, mm-hmm. Both of them are very prominent women. How have you felt about your children's marriages and their partner choices? And
well, they seem to have wonderful partner choices. You know, I think it's perfect for them. I think I chose them. No, I'm very proud of them, and I like what they do. And they seem to be happy. And they agree on most things. And they have their homes, and they have summer homes where they want them, and that's just swell.
What are your relationships with your daughters-in-law?
Well, they're very friendly. I love them very much. And they're close in their own way, but they're so busy too, you know. And I support them in what they do, and they support me in what I do. They're always there for me. And when I'm sick, my other daughter, my daughter-in-law, who is a physician at the U, is there to listen to the tests and go right into the lab, people. Yeah, they've been very supportive. I don't know, exactly how other families work, but I would say that they're close, and we get together. Mm-hmm. A couple of times a year for vacations, and we also get together for holidays, and we go out to dinner.
Are they both Jewish?
They were converted. They were both converts.
Was that something important to your family?
Yes, it was to Dan especially. Her father and her mother are not Jewish. In fact, her grandfather was a Methodist minister, but they're very nice people and very supportive, and they were there when she converted and everything. And my other daughter-in-law and her mother both converted. They were Catholics, not very devout apparently, but so.
Her mother-in-law converted.
Her mother.
Her mother, excuse me. Was that at the same time?
A little bit later, after they were married quite a few years.
What have you noticed about the relationship between these women as converts to Judaism in your family? Often they say converts are really a blessing to a family because they understand so much more than those who are born into the tradition.
Yeah, well, my daughters-in-law are both very academic, so Bobby has, she's joined the age, she's been president of AJC and all this stuff, and she's very devoted to the Federation, and she does her thing. I think she's a good daughter-in-law, and she's a good Jewish woman. And the other one went to Israel with Dan, and she learned how to speak and write Hebrew, and so she's pretty good in that too. And she's quite religious, I think.
And have they instilled that in your grandchildren?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. Yeah, Becky is kind of, but she is a counselor at camp, and she has been for years. And the other ones, yeah, they're pretty Jewish. A rabbi's son would have to be. And she's very supportive of him, and he's supportive of her. She's very busy at the U. They have marriages similar to ours, not as much argument, but, you know, they do their own thing sometimes, and they have their own activities. I think that's healthy. I wouldn't want somebody to be doing everything with me. I need my space, and I know Herb does, too.
So is that the survival and the success of your marriage?
I guess you could say it's a success. I don't know. We'll have to find out.
Well, to wrap up the interview, I want to go to a much broader arena and ask you some questions about being someone that has really witnessed changes nationally, internationally, and in Seattle for a good part of the 20th century. I didn't know whether or not there were particular events or landmark events that really had an impact on you that we haven't discussed. We did talk about the Depression and Vietnam and things like that, but I didn't know if there were things that I've missed.
Well, I was here when the State of Israel was formed and when the first war went on, and we were all out by the Masonic Temple and raising money. That's when we all worked together, Jews from all walks of life. And let's see if there was anything else that was world-shaking around here. Well, of course, the death of President Kennedy was quite world-shaking around here because this is a very Democratic county. And I was the treasurer of the 43rd District Democratic Club. And they had me on a hookup with talking to Lady Bird Johnson. And we exchanged views and questions.
What was the substance of that conversation?
Well, it was just how the Democratic Party was going to get along and survive, and I think there was nothing very academic about it. You know.
Where were you when you learned that Kennedy was shot?
In my house. I was off that day, and I picked up the phone, and of course it was dead. And then when I could get it, I called the president of the 43rd District Club, and we talked a bit about it. And then she said, just hold tight, not to get too excited. Things would go on, and they did, of course. But it was quite a shock. We didn't know too much about his private life, but we thought that he had done a good job. All but the problems with Cuba, with the Cuban Missile Crisis. But it's too bad that that happened. It was a big wake-up call for America, I think.
How so?
Well, I think that people realized that not only were people vulnerable, but presidents were vulnerable, too. And I don't think it taught us a lot about who we should have as presidents, but I think it taught us to be very wary of people who were liable to do you harm, maybe too much so. I don't know if it allowed the presidents to grow or not. But, that was kind of a sad wake-up call. You were too young to remember.
You mentioned the formation of the State of Israel. How would you feel that you yourself personally or the Seattle Jewish community felt the impact of the Holocaust?
Well, of course, many of my friends came from Germany, and we're in the Holocaust. My aunt in Russia, who never got over here with my father, with my grandmother over there, they were killed in Treblinka, so we know that it was close. But my friends, many of them, who would never talk about the Holocaust until just lately, Gazelle Berman, who wrote a book but would not talk, and her husband, who fed the dogs, and that's how he survived. And then Klaus Stern and his wife. And these are all people who were in the camps. And they seemed to be doing all right. Most of them were fairly young when they were in the camps, so they wouldn't have survived. Their families were all gone. And then Betty Zaltzschen and Lillian Eisler, who were good friends of mine, Betty still is, but they died. Well, she died, and her husband died, but I think it was hurried by the fact that they had no family left.
Hold on.